You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture.
In some kind of way, in Africa, you develop an affinity for innovation, and maybe that's to technology as well, because you always have to create your own hack to get things done. So where you don't have electricity, what you'll find in informal settlements is they'll cut a hole in the roof, put a plastic bottle with some water, and during the day that refracts the light to every space of the house. So it's almost, if you introduce something, picking it up becomes so much easier because you're always trying to find the next thing that will improve your life.
I had a friend who told me she applied for a product design degree here, and she got in, but she was the only person in the country who applied, so they didn't run the course. She was the only person in the whole country who applied for that degree.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
My name is Hulita Bagat from Nairobi Design Week.
And I'm Adrian Yankovyak from Nairobi Design Week.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. This week's episode comes from Nairobi, the first in a series of episodes we'll be bringing you from East Africa. At its most basic level, the identity of any world city is instantly recognisable by the silhouette of its architecture. From Sydney's Opera House to Paris's Eiffel Tower, we recognise and identify our cities by our buildings. Our theme for this year's festival, which runs throughout June, is identity. Of course, identity and architecture are much more closely entwined than just the look of our cities. The identity and cultural background of any architect has a profound influence on the architecture they create. London has always been an open and international city. Nearly a third of architects working in London are from overseas, including from the former colonies of the British Empire, and more recently from the European Union. Architects have brought their different backgrounds, identities, and ways of thinking to vastly improve the dynamism and creativity of London's architecture sector. And so too, London-based architects have travelled the world, creating some of the world's most iconic buildings in their wake. The looming effects of Brexit stand to change the identity of our architecture sector in many ways. To coincide with our festival this year, we wanted to explore ideas of architecture and identity more broadly. So we travelled to Kenya, Rwanda, and Ethiopia to bring you a series of Architecture Masters interviews. Given our changing identity, we thought these countries might offer some insights. How have architects working in Kenya and Rwanda had their identities influenced by their British and Belgian colonial histories? And what of Ethiopia, which largely escaped European colonialism, but was fascinatingly influenced by an Orthodox Christian architecture? Much has been talked about immigration and identity in the UK of late. So what then of the large-scale South Asian immigration into the Horn of Africa during British colonial rule? And what of the identity of architects themselves? Kenya has just 900 registered architects, about the same number of architects as living in Wales, and Rwanda has only just over 100. How does a relatively young profession define and identify itself with so few role models? There could scarcely be a more interesting trio of countries to learn about identity and architecture. These episodes have been made possible with help from the British Council's Arts Connects Us programme, for which we are immeasurably grateful. Our next few episodes come from Kenya, a young country which only gained independence from Britain in 1963. Over the next few episodes, we'll be speaking to Kenyan architects, designers, and educators, keen on finding out more about their work, but also exploring issues of identity and architecture. Later on, we'll bring more episodes from Rwanda and Ethiopia. For this week's episode, we're talking to Adrian Yankovyak and Hulita Bagat, co-directors of Nairobi Design Week, an organisation with a mission close to our own hearts, promoting design to a public audience. We spoke a little before this year's Nairobi Design Week, which took place in March. In a busy cafe in the Kilimani neighbourhood of Nairobi, I started by asking Adrian about the founding of Nairobi Design Week.
The idea came about in 2014, and the first festival took place in 2015.
And where did the idea come from?
So it was from necessity, really, but also through purely the idea came from myself wanting to actually visit a design week in Nairobi or in Kenya. So I asked my friends where the closest design week is, and I was told in Europe. And as it turns out, we looked online, and you know, there's Design Indaba, which is one of the best design shows in the world, really. So that was the first thought. But actually, you know, coming here as a human-centered designer, as a consultant working on NGO projects, I realized that I wasn't the most qualified person to do these projects. Actually, it should have been Kenyans, it should have been local designers. But the problem was that there weren't local designers with that skill set. So the only solution was to try and create some. And I think the way that we approached it was to try and give people within the community a platform to talk about design, to get together, to share ideas, and to have those conversations.
And where did your involvement? You're a designer by training?
I currently am still in training on human-centered design. But before that was a really long journey on what does design mean for me. And I've always had the interest. The thing is, in our background, when you go to school, design is not a career. Design is a hobby that you do on your free time. So I kind of struggled through school, constantly wanting to do more of the creative and being edged into doing something else, when finally I was allowed to do what they thought was okay, interior design. And I found there's a lack in an understanding of the market. The market in Kenya didn't really understand what interior design was for when I started. It was more of a, if I have money, I'm going to pay someone and I'm going to have my building or my house known as, hey, I hired an interior designer. So I really started to lose the passion and the hope for it. Loving spaces, I tried to do furniture design, and that's when I thought Nairobi Design Week was necessary. So I went online to register Nairobi Design Week and found it was registered like a few months before I did. So I reached out and joined the team.
Okay. And how big is the team? What's your...
It's currently 4 volunteers. So we have myself and Huli, and we manage most of the relationships and try to get the events off the ground. And then we have a designer, graphic designer, who helps with the website as well. And we have a communications intern who, again, helps us kind of manage those relationships and the day-to-day stuff.
Okay. But really a voluntary positions, people putting in their time to...
Currently, yes. Yeah. It's been, you know, since the beginning, it's been very much who wants to be involved and who wants to contribute. And, you know, the plan is to turn that into a business. I think this is the year where we're really hoping to start seeing some of those results. We have started understanding how this works and what we should be doing, what the community expects of us.
Okay.
So I think, yes.
So that transition to a more kind of commercial kind of founding.
Exactly.
Which I guess, you know, our kind of experience of the London Design Festival, yeah, that's kind of really developed into a kind of big commercial kind of proposition.
We're trying to learn from everyone around the world. The key thing is that Nairobi is so unique that it does have specific areas where we can't do the same thing as we might in London, or we have to work differently towards it. But I think the important thing is that we've really been focused on trying to understand ourselves, what we should be. You know, our theme this year is resource and community, because we've been focused on the community so much in the last year to really try and bring everyone together and see how we can better serve them. And it started as a passion project, you know.
So you describe Nairobi Design Week as a festival? Yeah, that's fair. So we're London Festival of Architecture. You know, I'm kind of interested what it means to be a festival or a week. I mean, a week is obvious, but you know what it means to be a festival. Yeah, if you're kind of trying to celebrate something, what's the kind of, yeah, what does that mean, you know, to be a...
The Nairobi Design Week is more of a celebration and an opportunity to showcase, introduce new concepts of design. As I mentioned before, we still have, as a nation, we still have a really limited understanding of the term design. If you Google design in Africa, the only thing that will pop up is fashion, and lots and lots and lots of fashion. So what we try to do is celebrate the uniqueness of how we interpret design also with our artisans and all the new design education that's popping up, try and encourage it and learn from it as well. So it is a celebration.
So, yeah, I'd add to that that I think when people hear festival, well, first of all, in Africa, there isn't such a culture of summer festivals yet. It's happening, and I think there are some great ones in Kenya.
Music festivals.
Exactly, yeah. That's what I think a lot of people traditionally associate with a festival. And we are trying to be as interactive as possible and still provide other medium, you know, you have music there and all of that. But we are very much now, I think, trying to involve the industry and give the industry a platform to speak to the public and to others within the industry. So it is a celebration, and it's also... We sum up what we do in kind of three ways. We connect people, so we connect ideas to people and organizations. We curate design, so through our platforms online, we try to show people what's newest in Nairobi and give them a better understanding of design. And we create projects, so we create collaborations between organizations and between ideas and project opportunities.
So I'm really interested then, I mean, for us on the Architecture Festival, part of it is about bringing the community together, bringing kind of architects together to exchange ideas and for the industry to come together. And then another part is that kind of public engagement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe just say a few words about kind of how you engage a public audience in becoming more design literate and design kind of conscious.
Like I said, we've been really focused, I think, on getting the word out, and it's now starting to become clearer that, you know, people within the industry know us or are starting to know us, and then people in public, some might become aware. And I think it's bridging that gap, as Huli said, of when you want to become a designer, it's just, well, okay, first go become a lawyer, do something proper. And then once you graduate, maybe you can become a designer in your spare time. But it's never seen as a profession, and it's never really seen as something viable or something even important. So our big step is to actually show people practical implications of design. If we bring an Italian chair here and display it and say it's on sale for 5,000 euros, some people might be interested, but most people will never be able to afford that. Most people in Europe wouldn't be able to afford that. And so we try to actually give the community and the public practical examples of how design can be used. So whether that's in Kibera for housing, or whether it's solving service issues in transportation, it's something that Nairobians can apply day-to-day life.
And does design here have that, you know, reputation as being kind of for rich people? You know, that's the kind of, certainly a reputation maybe in the UK, the kind of high-end design. Whereas actually, I mean, we were talking earlier about design in informal settlements and design, yeah, that's where it can have a huge influence.
It depends on what your understanding of design is. If you're looking at some professions, if you say interior design, that's definitely something they'd consider for the rich. But locally, we've been having design for decades and decades. You'll find, for example, we cook with a jiko, which is like a coal burner. I don't know how to translate it to English. It's a coal burner,
a stove.
And that's design, and that's created purely for low-income earners. they you can't afford a gas cooker. So I wouldn't say it is for a specific type. It depends on what it is you're looking for. And what we are trying to do at Nairobi Design Week is kind of bridge that understanding, kind of let everyone know that design is problem solving. It's not for the rich, it's not for the poor, it's not for anyone in life. It's for how to live a good quality of life. So what can you do with it?
Okay. And then I guess I was interested in Kenya is really known for its kind of tech development, and you know, people talk about Silicon Savannah and the kind of involvement of technology and design. You know, how much of that kind of stretches into your work? I mean, how much do you think about sort of technology aspects of design?
So I think it's, you know, clear that in the last half a decade or decade, you know, so many places have popped up in Kenya, in Nairobi, this whole term of Silicon Savannah. Technology is extremely important, and I think currently, because of the vibe for entrepreneurship around the world and the keenness of people to be involved in that, I think that's the hot topic. And I think linked to that is technology and apps and the importance of that. So people approach it that way, and I think they will get to design through technology, through I need to develop an interface for my app, therefore it needs to be well designed. But I think Kenyans in general, Kenya as a country, seems to me in some ways more technologically advanced than many countries that I've been to around the world. If you look at M-Pesa, which celebrated its 10-year anniversary last year, it's an electronic payment service. It's being in London with friends in a pub, it seems strange to me that I can't text them money, because that's how it works. And we might have other ways to deal with that, Apple Pay and so on, in a big city like London or New York. But that's certainly not as an applicable technology as M-Pesa is, where 70% of the country uses M-Pesa here, you know? Everyone knows the term, and everyone, even your grandma in a village 300 kilometers away, would still be able to use that technology. So I think technology, about technology becoming more accessible, that's what Kenya is great at, kind of understanding how technology functions around the world, and then how can we apply it to our own needs.
How's technology then, say you're studying, where are you studying, where's your university?
I'm doing human-centered design at the Nairobi Design Institute.
Okay.
It is fairly new, just began 8 months ago.
Okay.
Just 8 months ago, yeah.
And then, yeah, well, I guess technology, yeah, human-centered design, do you want to say a beautiful kind of interpretation of human-centered design, just for... Yeah, if we've got a slightly more architectural audience, they might...
Okay, so human-centered design is a creative approach to problem solving, and it's focused around the user, where you come up with potential solutions to that custom to whatever need it is they may have. My favorite example is, for the longest time growing up in Kenya, all we heard about was NGOs taking children off the street. With human-centered design approach, it's not building a school or coming up with a hospital in the area where these children or unemployed peoples may be. It's going back to them, conversing with them, finding out, having empathy, and trying to figure out what would work from their perspective. A lot of the time you'll find the person with the problem actually has the solution. And as a designer, we're just to guide that and bring it out.
Okay. Which is not too dissimilar to the kind of the process of architecture, I guess, as architects working with
definition
potential users.
Yeah. Solving problems.
Yeah. We like, I say at the festival, we like a broad definition of design, and architects increasingly doing, maybe I guess during economic downturns when fewer things are getting built, you know, there's a more of a kind of trend for architects to move into product design and to other design.
What about the way architecture applies something like a human-centered design methodology, which says fail often? And obviously, and being an industrial designer is the same. The stakes are very high. You know, for an architect, you do something wrong, a lot of people can get hurt at once. For an industrial designer, a million products at once can do something wrong. It must be a kind of big gap, I guess, to jump.
So say maybe just you're a product designer by
training. I'm an industrial designer by trade, yes.
So just say a bit about your education, your background. Okay. So you're born...
I'm born in Poland.
Okay.
I'm fully Polish and I moved to the UK when I was 7.
Okay.
So went to primary, secondary and then in the UK and went to university at Loughborough Uni. Studied industrial design there. And after that, I went into working for an FMCG, fast moving consumer goods, working on their new technologies group. So really working across sort of 20 or 30 of their top brands, from Dettol, Clearasil, Durex, Strepsils, looking at how their products might look in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. So it was really a combination of gathering human insights and gathering empathy for the user and then trying to find technologies to fit those insights and to create products from them. And then from there, I left that. I knew that I wanted to leave England. I knew that I wanted to go to a different country and explore the world. During university, I'd already designed some toys in India. So I kind of opened the world up and managed to get a job in Kenya after about 6 months to a year of freelancing in London. And after that, worked for an NGO here, for a Gates NGO, doing water and sanitation work with design thinking and creating businesses, trying to create self-sustaining businesses around water and sanitation service.
And that kind of NGO influence to design then, coming on to some of the kind of technology about kind of solar and about, is that a big part of the design scene in Kenya?
Yes, it's. I think solar is, again, another technology where Africa is ahead, yeah. I would say, in the sense that the users are ahead, because it's not unusual for someone here, for an elderly person, to know how to use a solar lamp. I don't think that would be the same in of my grandparents in Poland.
Yeah.
And actually, yes, I worked for a company called Greenlight Planet here, who do Sun King solar lights. So they're in 55 countries. They've sold over 7 million lights now. So one of their biggest markets is Kenya.
Yeah.
And I think they've sold probably over 1 million of those lamps actually in Kenya and East Africa. So there are definitely areas where Africa is kind of jumping a step ahead, perhaps because there was a lack of infrastructure, like we see with cell phones, no landlines, like we see with lighting, with electricity. It's actually jumping ahead, where Europe might be left, and the US is left with old infrastructure these days, and Africa doesn't have that problem because it didn't have it in the first place sometimes. Exactly, yeah.
I think in some kind of way, in Africa, you develop an affinity for innovation, and maybe that's to technology as well, because you always have to create your own hack to get things done. So where you don't have electricity, what you find in informal settlements is they cut a hole in the roof, put a plastic bottle with some water, and during the day that refracts the light to every space of the house.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's almost, if you introduce something, picking it up becomes so much easier because you're always trying to find the next thing that will improve your life.
Yeah. And I'm really interested in you brought in that kind of connection, I guess, between architecture and design in informal settlements. I guess one of the things that architects get criticism for in the UK is thinking, kind of imposing their own view on how people live and on how people should live. Just kind of interested in your thoughts on how buildings are designed for people using them, and whether there's a different attitude maybe in Africa to that kind of user of buildings.
I wouldn't say it's a different attitude. It's about how well you do your job. If you're gonna design a building, if you're gonna let's talk about hospitals. I shouldn't have touched on that. Hospitals are a bit of a challenge in Kenya, I'll say, especially the public hospitals. You're going to design a hospital where in a culture, certain things are taboo or frowned upon. HIV, for example, you're not treated as another human being. You're treated as a HIV person. So in a hospital, you'll find that the design allows for them to separate HIV patients from the rest of the patients. And that's not the goal of a hospital. You're not going in so that everybody can announce that, hey, look on the other side. Oh my God, so-and-so is there. She has AIDS. It doesn't work like that. It's how you think about your profession, how well you execute what it is you're doing. Because at the end of the day, when you're building, you are building for the user. You're not building so that you can go and stay in there. It's for the person you've built it for.
So, I mean, the other interesting thing then, we've talked a little bit about architecture as historical baggage maybe connected with architecture and historical references. I guess architecture's got quite, yeah, the kind of products last longer maybe, and there's a longer kind of legacy. In terms of kind of cultural influences in design, then you talked a little bit about fashion and the kind of culture there. Is there a wider kind of Kenyan cultural influence in design, in product design, human-centered design?
Beyond architecture.
Well, no, actually in design, rather than beyond architecture. Absolutely, in other kind of design.
I find that an interesting question. Right now, there's this, the rise of the Africa happening, where everything is in African prints, everything is geared to it was made in Africa, and I'm really happy about that. There's a huge sense of pride. I do think we do, as designers, we need to challenge that a little bit more and move it from just saying I have African print on what I'm making, so now it's African. These things about our history, these things about our culture, these things about how we created things for our environment that can be applied to our new designs. So, for example, what can I think of that's really traditional that it'd be interesting to see? I'd like to see a hat that kind of mimics a pot, because we know traditionally we carried pots in our heads. It'd be interesting to just see people come up with concepts that are from our history and apply them to our modern day.
I think there's we're in a really good, strong place right now for African design. And this is coming from someone who hadn't been here 5 or 10 years ago, so I don't know how it was. But I can tell you that when I first came to Kenya, I hadn't heard African music in the charts, apart from, you know, in London, sometimes a Ghanaian or something, right? And the same thing has happened with design. African design wasn't visible 5 years ago. And now you've got, the whole industry really looking at Africa, because everyone's bored with it's already been done. Yeah. People are kind of bored with Danish minimalism. Everyone wants maximalism now. But actually, African print and African design styles really fit well with that, because it's often to do with craftsmanship. It's often to do with details. It's to do with brightness and color, and I think, so what we are seeing, as you've seen kind of, you've seen South American music and South American design come in, I think now is Africa's turn, with music kind of leading the way and design and other forms of culture coming through as well. People really starting to open themselves up.
So you've previously worked then for a multinational, looking at kind of product design mm-hmm. in the country. Do you think we're at the stage of the reverse of that? Yeah, in terms of, yeah, obviously one of the parts of a festival is looking at kind of business opportunities and creating opportunities for designers here to grow their businesses and to kind of trade maybe more internationally. Are we kind of at the stage of international expansion?
I think from the perspective that African design is being taken on by multinationals, and you do see, you know, there are controversies because, for example, the Maasai pattern was taken by which label? I can't remember. Yeah. It was taken by a fashion label and used and culturally appropriated, so to speak. And actually, someone did a calculation for how much money the Maasai community loses if that pattern was trademarked every year. So,
that kind of cultural appropriation is a really interesting.
And I think people overuse that word sometimes as well. But I think so. Definitely, there is, you know, multinationals are trying to look at African design, and I think designers can learn a lot from actually African heritage and the culture of how Africans live. Yeah. I think that actually, you know, Africans very much appreciate nature and the land they live from, and they have that connection where, I can speak for Kenyans anyway, where most Kenyans I speak to want to do agriculture in some form in their lives. Now, if you go to speak to Londoners and ask how many want to do agriculture and have a farm, yeah, it'll be a very low outcome. Yeah. So I think, actually, yeah, we are learning from kind of the cradle to cradle mentality as well.
And your perceptions then on that kind of cultural appropriation, what's...
First of all, I'm not very sure I know what that means.
Okay.
The thing about cultural appropriation here is there's a thin line between what we ourselves as design, as Kenyan designers can do and gentrification.
Yeah.
Because as much as we are blending a lot of design disciplines, international design disciplines, and combining a lot of inspiration from both of them, a majority of our population are still living below the amount of money,
poverty line.
So a lot of the things that are going to be bought, a lot of the things that are going to be sold or seen worn on our streets are going to be what they can afford, which is, you know, shipments that came back from London or from the US. So when you talk about cultural appropriation, who's the number of people who have the education or the fight in them to make sure this doesn't happen is limited. And we need to start at our own levels, our own individual levels, start looking at it as a not his or her problem, as how do we create an environment where everyone gets equal opportunities to appreciate the same things. Yes, there's so many Kenyans who want to do farming. There's so many Kenyans who appreciate the outdoors. But at the same time, there's a majority who can't wait to be able to afford a car. There's a majority who can't wait to be able to have that watch they saw on that girl or to live in a fancier house than, you know, the really cool mud hut that, you know, could be developed into something amazing. It's just that appreciation level and that gap being bridged that I think would be...
Yeah,
suited.
I think if you look at the people at the forefront who are within the industry, they are already moving past that, and they are moving into how can we use, for example, local materials to improve ventilation, right? But if you look at the majority of the population, that it's very much top down. But I think there are initiatives such as, you know, the plastic bag ban came in last year, and there has been a visible decrease in bags, but more importantly, people's mindsets change. When you now don't have a plastic bag to throw your trash in, you actually have to think of a different way to deal with it. So you become more resourceful with the way you deal with the plastic bags that you do get.
And just to add on to that, there's a young girl, I can't remember her name right now, but that affinity I talked about to innovation. Immediately after the plastic bag ban, there's a young girl who created this bag out of banana leaves, and it created a really good buzz.
So a design solution to...
She found a design solution to
okay.
it. And it goes back to what you need, finding solutions for what you need.
And on that note, I think it's about explaining to people and making people understand that design solutions don't have to be a huge building. It's not necessarily the National Museum redesigned. It could be a bottle of water in your roof, you know. It could be just plugging a hole. It could be anything where you are trying to solve your own problems, and you are trying to actually create a viable solution. And then people can kind of start to realize that a lot of the country, or everyone in the country, is a designer. You know, we like to say that everyone's a designer. I think that cliche, but it's about making people understand that actually, it's not a bad thing if you're creative. It's not a bad thing if you have to do something for yourself or solve a problem yourself. You're capable of doing that.
Yeah, I saw you.
And then I guess I'm interested in talking a little bit whilst we're here to Kenyan schools of architecture and looking at the transition from largely maybe foreign educated architects who've had to go overseas to study, and the transition now to more locally educated architects. Kind of interested in how design is taught in Kenya, and I guess the need to kind of grow the capacity, you know, the number of people who are trained if you're going to grow the kind of design industry. What's your kind of take on design teaching in the country?
First of all, it's a long time ago since I was in school.
Okay. So. Well, school, architecture, well, school, like, university, you know, kind of.
That is true.
Yeah.
You can edit that out. I mean, it's a long time ago since I was in primary school.
You just told the audience. Do you mean higher level?
Well, I mean all, I guess kind of moving on to kind of graduate and.
Because for one, the school I'm in right now is a small incubation.
Okay.
And we are 8 of us.
Right. Okay.
And as the first cohort, it's very.
That's a risk for you then. I mean, taking, you know, starting a new. Yeah.
Well, everything's worth a risk.
Yeah.
You never know what comes out of it. And
so
also
eight in the first cohort.
Yes.
Okay.
So the first cohort is 8 of us, and the approach here is, as it's being tested also for the first time, guinea pigs us.
Yeah.
Happy to be guinea pigs.
Yeah.
The director here is that Tosh, I'm happy to be a guinea pig. His approach is very different, and I think it's also going to challenge the way education has been given in Kenya.
Okay.
It's very experimental. It's very practical. We get to be in the field. We actually get to learn whilst on the job. Whereas what I remember from the very long time ago when I was in school in trying to get my papers in interior design and from high school, the design education was very textbook. Mm-hmm. But I also studied during the 844 system, where a lot of the time we mastered what was in the book, and that's how we passed our exams.
Right.
And design was no different. Design is a very personal experience with what you're interacting with. So what I would find is if the teacher didn't like what I created, then that's a fail.
Yeah.
There's no win, or you have to be very accustomed to the way the system works. I do feel that the education sector is changing a lot. We've been interacting with university students and intend on doing quite a lot more with them now. And there's an openness and a willingness for the design lecturers, the design teachers, to start using more international approaches. That again goes back to exposure. So I think the more exposed you are, the better the education system becomes, because now you can't find a student saying, hey, this is what I read about online, why can't we talk about that in class? It has to become much more integrated. It has to become much more inclusive of what's happening in the world and in our own context.
So I guess there's a way of importing teaching methods without necessarily kind of importing the kind of cultural baggage maybe that goes with some of those teaching methods, do you think? I mean, in terms of way you can look at different ways of teaching without maybe looking at importing the kind of culture connected with that teaching, maybe.
It does make sense, yeah. I'd agree with you. I think there's a need for more apprenticeships, a need for more internships for especially young designers coming up. Because the unique thing about our career is it's the process. And because the process keeps reinventing itself, you constantly need to be there doing. You can't just read about it and know.
Yeah. And that depends, I guess, on the sector growing and there being more firms that can offer apprenticeships and can offer opportunities and can offer that.
And equally a willingness from the students to give out their time, you know?
Yeah.
It's like what I'm doing as a guinea pig. It's, you have to be willing to take that time out. You have to be willing to risk it all for the benefit of what you really want to do for your passion.
That's really interesting in terms of how people volunteer and donate their time. You know, there's a big controversy, I guess, in the UK and in other countries about bigger architecture firms hiring students for free and getting them to do free work. And I guess this is different, that you're volunteering to create something new. You're not giving your time to another company to see it kind of prosper.
What I'd say to that is how you understand your creative worth, your understanding what the value of what you're doing is. Once you're able to put a value on the amount of work you're doing, you're able to say, I need this amount of time or I need this certain skills to improve. Where's the balance? Because I feel like I'm learning so much from giving my time.
Yeah.
My worth has definitely gone up.
There's a benefit for you. Yeah.
There is. Okay. So you just need to find that perfect balance within yourself to know that this is how long I can give for this amount of studies and grow from there.
Yeah. And so is university education here, do you pay for university education? Is it a similar system to in the UK? You end up taking out huge loans and you end up actually paying for your education as well as your living expenses. Is that a...
Yes, you end up paying for your expenses. There are, of course, scholarships, and there's lots of private schools. Those that give you either scholarship or you pay, and it's not cheap.
No, okay.
And there's the public schools where... You can either get a scholarship or pay a certain amount depending on your grades.
Okay.
So if you have to do a parallel year, then of course it's going to cost much more.
Yeah.
Or if you just got in on correct terms, then the fees is kind of subsidized, almost affordable.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of school loan systems that are working now.
Okay.
A lot of banks have actually seen the value of education and allowing students to take loans that they pay after employment.
It's just interesting, in the UK there's a lot of talk about how diverse architecture is as a profession in terms of access to people from kind of less well-off backgrounds, and whether they can go to architecture school and pay the fees and everything else. It's just interesting. Is that an issue in terms of access to education, access to design kind of?
I think student support everywhere, right? I think on that proportional scale. It's certainly not easy to get into design here. First of all, because of the cultural and the family barriers that you might have, and then actually making it happen. Finding at school, I had a friend who told me she applied for a product design degree here, and she got in, but she was the only person in the country who applied. So they didn't run the course. She was the only person in the whole country who applied for that degree.
Yeah.
Which is sad. And actually, I've spoken in other schools as well to lecturers, and some of them will tell you that, especially for something like industrial design, there hasn't been the facility to make that happen, because industrial design, architecture as well, is something that you need a lot of, capital expenditure for a lot of the time, whether it's 3D printers, etc., workstations, right? I think architecture, I've been very impressed with some of the architecture work that I've seen here. And I think out of all the design disciplines, it's one of the most developed, I'd say. Fashion, definitely, obviously, and furniture and interiors. But I think architecture is also really has, when you go to the university, you can see that there are students who have talent, who have put hours in and done the work. And I can't say that for every field of design here. I also wanted to say that kind of from the very beginning, when you look at schools, art and design and other creative subjects aren't encouraged necessarily in schools, because again, there is sometimes that kind of throwback to the past that you should be, science, maths, English, right? And you should be a lawyer or something. And that carries on into actually the ministry, which is responsible for, you could say, creatives and design. And I can't even repeat the name of it. It's the Ministry of Tourism and Culture and Sports Culture and gender. Design
fairly,
fits under
fairly
that.
Narrow remit they've got then.
Exactly, and design fits under that, so you can imagine that their priority is not design.
And just to touch on what he said, when you grow up in Kenya in our schools, you're not studying art as a discipline of different combinations of what design is. It's art, and music. So art includes all forms of design. It includes crafts, all of that in one course. And then you do music. And then there's home science. And then there's cooking. And then it's just a whole mashup of everything. So specializing becomes a completely different thing. And I think that's something I can personally talk about, because when I wanted to do art, I didn't know what I could do with art. I didn't know what I could do with creativity. I knew I'm either going to make houses pretty, or I'm going to build nice furniture or play with colorful fabrics. It was until much later when I got really curious, or until I took my own passion, that I discovered, oh my goodness, there's graphic design, there's product design, there's architecture, there's that the field actually expands and I could be specific about what I wanted to do.
That's really interesting. And you kind of mentioned the government kind of angle. It's one of the things that's really interested us in the festival in London, is how we engage with government and persuade them of the value of architecture. I guess the similarities here about persuading government about the value of design. Is that a kind of a future for the for the Nairobi Design Week? Is that something that kind of you want to
engage? Absolutely, it's the current.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah. We realize that to show the government the importance of design has to be important. And to be important, it has to have an impact.
Yeah.
So we are trying, therefore, to set up these projects that have short-term impacts, so you can see some quick wins, and then longer-term impacts, so actually you can see what's happening within society and how design is contributing to not just the creative sector and the creative economy, but actually to society as a whole.
Okay.
I'd agree. How I'd phrase it is, one of the rules of Nairobi Design Week, long-term rules, short-term goals, is how can we prove that design should inform policy?
Yeah.
Everything we look at in our environment, in our built environment, in our living environment is very not to standard, if I would say. There's so many. I'll talk more about infrastructure. The Kenyan roads are just something else. There's so many things I could touch on that. But if design is not being allowed to make the decisions or being included in the decisions being made about how we build around ourselves and how we live our lives, then the end result becomes something that needs to be redone.
Yeah. So it's about involving designers at a really early stage within kind of government thinking. And it's interesting, we're having exactly the same arguments in London. Yeah, these things never, I mean, it's a process, isn't it? It takes time to convince people that, so we find getting architects, you know, trying to make the case for involving architects in thinking about, you know, again, London, you know, UK has big problems with infrastructure spending and not having joined up thinking, not having designers involved at an early stage in thinking about how people will use infrastructure. It's
interesting, because every place has its problems and every place sees its own problems. Yeah. And then you might have an architect in Kenya looking at London thinking, how lucky are those guys, right?
Yeah.
And I think actually that happens, you know, the other way as well. You might look at a designer in England and say, you know, how lucky are they that it's less regulated, or that you can actually, you know, create something, just, you know, go on the street and have prototypes made.
Yeah.
So I think obviously
there's a lot to learn both
exactly,
ways.
Exactly. Yeah.
So just then maybe kind of starting to round up, just thinking about the future of Nairobi Design Week. Where you're planning, where you're going. Can you say a bit about your thoughts about... So the next edition of the festival takes place in March?
March the 18th to the 25th.
Okay.
Yeah. So we've got just...
Just a few weeks left. And what... How will people... You know, what sort of events and things are you running? What's the... what are the plans?
So, like we mentioned, the theme is resource and community. So resource being looking at how we can better use resources, for all the way from educational resources and how we can provide those, to reusing plastic, looking at electronic waste, looking at textile waste. So we have organizations attending from each of these areas. and then community. So actually bringing the placemaking community together, looking at how what we can do out on the streets more, how we can actually affect the public in a good way and put design out into the public eye as well. So we've got a number of events that are kind of more tailored towards industry and some that are towards the public. So we're having a careers in design day. So what's really kind of as on this conversation, you know, we've realized that there are a lot of people that want to learn, a lot of people that want to teach, but if we can bring them together, share those resources, bring the agencies who are hiring, looking for new talent, because we get phone calls most days saying, I need a graphic designer, I need an architecture intern, whatever it is. And we end up in that connecting spot. So again, that's kind of a platform, kind of like new designers in the UK, you know, I can't lie, that has to be an inspiration, you know. And then looking at, we've got our Africa Design event, which is an industry event, which will have speaker panels around resource and around community, and again, workshops. And then at the end of the week, we're having a Maker Day. So it's called Make a Day of It, and it's all about having organizations come in where you can interact with the public. So if we have artisans, for example, making jewelry, they'll come, but they'll actually be making live jewelry. And then if someone's making clay pots, they'll have the opportunity to paint that clay pot on site and interact with the people behind the products, you know? So that's kind of a few things that we've got planned.
I have to say, I think Make a Day of It is one of my funnest days that we're expecting, just because for the first time, and I think before I say that, it's more important that I add that we really do understand that design hasn't really been expounded to all its abilities, and we found a need to introduce it. So starting from what do people understand design is, they know it's fashion or crafting, blah blah blah, and then combine that with more advanced concepts. We're going to have 3D printing, and you know, there's going to be displays of architecture and all of that. So kind of trying to find a way to ease the community into learning and being interested in more than what design really is and its abilities.
And we've got some really interesting installations as well, you know, on the theme of resource, recycled plastics. And also we've got the Better Shelter, the version 2. So the Better Shelter Foundation have sent us their new refugee shelter, and that will be hosting workshops by the University of Edinburgh during the festival as well, around the theme of displacement and refugees. And that will be something that, again, not many Kenyans have had the chance to see a refugee shelter, you know? So we're hoping that will start conversations as well.
Okay, about habitat and about how people live and about...
And, you know, I see those conversations going in all sorts of ways. Yeah. We were at London Design Festival and we were talking to someone who said they're looking at how you can reclaim rooftops in London by fitting, you know, additional space. When you look at Nairobi, most rooftops are covered in water tanks, which is a waste of space. So actually, you know, you can imagine someone coming and seeing a pop-up refugee shelter and thinking, well, why can't I design, you know, like a wiki house for Kenya, for example, and place it somewhere?
That, I mean, it's kind of interesting to think a little bit then about the sort of meanwhile space idea, which is becoming kind of big thing in London, you know, temporary kind of installations. Is that kind of concept starting here, do you think, the idea of kind of pop-up things before development are happening?
I think the pop-up concept as the kind of hipsterized pop-up concept has definitely arrived, you know. When it comes to the kind of living space situation, I think a lot of Kenyans are already stuck in a temporary living scenario when you look at it officially, because all slums are informal settlements. So actually that, and you know, we only had a fire 2 days ago in a slum here, and it killed 3 people. It displaced 6,000 people, became homeless in the space of 8 hours. So now they have to rebuild, they have to find another place, because a lot of those people don't, they've been there 2 generations and they don't even want to go back to the same place now. So I think what the fascinating thing is architecture, which perhaps isn't as permanent as 20 or 50 years down the line, but something that isn't in the 18-month space, you know, because a lot of slums are built with 18 months to 2 years in mind, and then people live there for 15 years. So what is that kind of space that perhaps architects in other countries haven't been looking at as much, and how can we focus on getting in there?
I think the twist to that thought is living in the city for Kenyans isn't your final destination. You move to the city to earn while you send money back home to have your house, village, how, you know, you set that up. So having that temporary mindset of I'm going to stay here for a short time and not thinking, okay, maybe my children might inherit where I'm staying, doesn't really put that in the minds of the people living there.
So it makes all architecture more kind of temporary in a sense, more kind of transitory.
It is created with a temporary initially, but ends up being long term. And this is something we should definitely pick up as a conversation as Nairobi Design Week. And yeah. And you'd also mentioned about the future of Nairobi Design Week. Our future is very evolving with the design scene. We don't want to say it's a group of four people who are Nairobi Design Week. Nairobi Design Week is a huge community. So we are going to constantly move with what's happening in the scene. If the scene veers towards informal settlements and housing, then that's where we are going to go. If
it's about,
it can be about us.
About being responsive to your users, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's human-centered festival in that case.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly it. I think we're very weary of not... Yeah, as much as we want to be a platform for the community, we don't want to be the only voice of the community. We have to realize that there are other people, and we do try to give as many people access to that voice as possible. And going forward, you know, myself being a foreigner, I came to a human-centered design job, which if there had been human-centered designers who were Kenyan, I wouldn't have been in that job. And I again feel if, you know, it was just a matter of time before someone started a Nairobi Design Week. It was going to happen. And it just so happened that it was started by a foreigner with the idea that it's fully Kenyan. And the long-term ambition is I would love to personally come back in 30, 50 years' time, see a Nairobi Design Week, see it flourishing, but see it being run by Kenyans and East Africans.
Yeah. I've been really interested in some of the architecture firms who have, again, in a similar way, you know, had that foreign impetus maybe and have transitioned to become fully Kenyan, fully African. And, so how then, just finally, how can people find out more about the festival? How can they, what's the...
Okay, you can find it on nairobidesignweek.com. We're Nairobi Design Week on Instagram and on Facebook, and Nairobi Design WK on Twitter, because the handle's too
long.
Too long.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, we hope everyone will find out more.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. You can find out more about Adrian and Julita and Nairobi Design Week at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this will help others to discover the programme. Music for this week's episode was from Raw Music International and the Kisumu Mixtape with Peter Lagono, available via the Free Music Archive and released under a Creative Commons licence. You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse in Nairobi. Thank you for listening.